Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's new London correspondent in Westminster. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
We're back from the summer break just in time to witness the British political system turning itself into a Hollywood fireball.
Yes, indeed. Boris Johnson has lost control of Brexit and has demanded an election. And the opposition and Tory rebels have taken control of Brexit and want to control the timing of the election. And that's just the start of it.
We've had many unprecedented weeks here on Brexit Republic, but the blistering developments at Westminster this week have reached new depths in the sundering of British politics.
We'll dissect the week's drama and the reaction from Brussels, and we'll be joined by RTE's political correspondent Micheál Lehane to talk about how the Irish government is bracing itself for no deal, if indeed that's what happens at the end of October.
Although at this stage it's impossible to predict exactly how things are going to unfold. But let's start, Sean, with Boris Johnson. Since Brexit Republic was last on air, he was elected Prime Minister, swept into Downing Street on a blaze of oomph and do-or-die spirit, declaring he would bring the UK out on the 31st of October, come what may. And then, oops. So, Sean, how do we characterise, as briefly as possible, the past 6 weeks?
Well, five of them have been fairly all right for Boris Johnson, mainly because he hasn't been facing Parliament, apart from that really brief appearance the day after he became Conservative Party leader. But this week, it's all gone wrong for him. It's, what, 1 week of facing into a Parliament as Prime Minister of the country, and he's a serial loser already. He's lost his very first vote as Prime Minister when the opposition and Tory rebels outfoxed him, got the numbers in order to take control of the House of Commons order paper. Then they tried to bring in this bill that they believe will prevent Britain from leaving the European Union without a deal at the end of October. Boris Johnson tried to stop that, but he failed in that vote. And then he immediately called for a general election. But of course, there's a fixed-term Parliament Act here in Britain now since 2011. So Prime Ministers can't just call snap elections. They have to go to the House of Parliament and ask for permission and get a two-thirds majority. And guess what? He failed to get that two-thirds majority. He did sort of win the vote, but he just didn't get enough. Fell well short of the required number of votes. And so three strikes and, well, you can't even be out, I'm afraid, at this stage. So we are now in the situation where we have Boris Johnson holding the office of Prime Minister, but certainly not having the power of a Prime Minister. And it's a pretty crazy situation. We think there's going to be another attempt on Monday to bring in a motion to try and get this fixed-term Parliament Act necessary majority to get an election going. But of course, the opposition aren't in a hurry to give Mr. Johnson what he wants, because what they want is for him to go to Brussels and do what he doesn't want to do, which is ask the European Union for an extension to the Brexit deadline. And all this talk about do or die, we're leaving on the 31st of October. Well, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably worth looking back at his election campaign to become leader, because he really was, you know, streets ahead of Jeremy Hunt, remember him. And, you know, he was crowned at the end of July. There was a great surge of optimism and belief within the Conservative Party after the May years, which were characterised by such doldrums and poisonous politics of Westminster and so on. And certainly in Brussels, his rise was being watched very carefully, and people were wondering which Boris Johnson would step forward. Would it be the One Nation Conservative, socially liberal Boris Johnson from his days as London mayor, or would he be much more driven by the right wing of his party? And I can say that from my own contacts here in Brussels, the day that he came to power, and then in this 24 hours later when Dominic Cummings entered the fray, he of course was the head of the Vote Leave campaign, was the kind of Svengali of that whole movement, which has been so divisive for a lot of people. There was almost an audible deflation in Brussels when that news went out, because he was simply not a really properly understood character, and he wouldn't be a direct interlocutor either for the European Union. So this really characterised the start of his tenure.
Indeed, but it might have been a deflating moment in Brussels, but I can tell you here in London, it was an electrifying moment. The return of Dominic Cummings to active political campaigning really galvanised things around here. Remember, he was the star of the Vote Leave campaign. Indeed, he became the star of a movie that was made about it, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, perhaps best known for international viewers as the Marvel character Doctor Strange, but he's also played Sherlock Holmes in more recent incarnations. It's probably the first time I can certainly think of a backroom political fixer type person starring in a real life movie drama about themselves, but he has become, perhaps unfortunately for Boris Johnson, something of a hate figure now, certainly in the Tory party, and mainly because of sackings. Two events in particular. One was the sacking of a media advisor to Sajid Javid, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was sacked on the spot by Mr. Cummings and then escorted out of Downing Street by an armed police officer. That really played very, very badly with a lot of people here, not just the special advisors, not just the civil servants, but politicians as well. And there was the beginning of a real pushback against Mr. Cummings. And then, of course, the threat, which was eventually carried out, that anybody, any of the politicians who rebelled against the government would be sacked. And that is exactly what happened. 21 people were sacked the other night. That led to Boris Johnson being given, by all accounts, a pretty torrid time at the 1922 backbench committee. People simply thinking, this sort of thing is wrong. What sort of thing are we talking about? Well, people like Ken Clark, the father of the house, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, somebody who really incarnates the phrase Tory grandee. He's been booted out of the party, as has Sir Nicholas Soames, the grandson of Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister that Boris Johnson idolises, really, wrote a biography about him. He too kicked out of the party. Rory Stewart, one of the leadership contenders during that summer campaign, sacked by a text message from the Chief Whip's office. Again, this hasn't played well with the backbenchers. Not sure about how it's playing with the voters of this country, but it has led to a roiling mood within the Conservative Party. There's no doubt about that. And a lot of the focus for the anger has been Mr. Cummings himself. The other focus for anger has been Mr. Rees-Mogg, who now occupies a government front bench position, and occupied the front bench indeed on Monday evening during the debate there. The pictures of him lying on the front bench as various backbenchers made impassioned, worthy speeches was seen to be some act of Victorian disdain for what these people were saying. Again, that played really badly. The memes on social media have been absolutely fantastic. But again, it looks really bad for the government. It looks like a government out of touch with the people. And those two things, the sackings and the Rees-Mogg, the Jacob Rees-Mogg lying on the bench, I think they have been really, really bad for the Conservatives and for Boris Johnson. And then, of course, we've got resignations going on in the party. His own brother, Joe Johnson, a junior minister in the government, is stepping down from politics and obviously from the government, saying he cannot reconcile his family loyalties with what he believes to be the national interest. So the Johnson family itself at war, as is much of this country.
And of course, the whole rationale or the whole argument that Boris Johnson has been putting forward in his first appearances in the House of Commons and in his attempt to face down the Tory rebels and the opposition, has been that any move of that nature would cut the legs of his negotiating strategy. He had promised to go to Brussels to get rid of the backstop, and if the EU had any inkling that Parliament would prevent a no-deal Brexit, then that would take the initiative away from his negotiating strategy, and the EU would simply sit tight and wait for things to play out and wouldn't budge. I mean, is that the best way to boil down his whole strategy here? You know, whatever about the stylistic problems associated with Dominic Cummings.
Yeah, I think it is, and it's what he ran on in the leadership contest during the summer. He made no secret that this was going to be the approach, that you had to put it up to Brussels and have this credible threat to escalate things, to catch their attention and say, look, we are serious about this, even though we know it's going to be very, very difficult, if not disastrous for the British economy. We're still prepared to go through with this because we believe so passionately in getting out of the European Union, but not on the terms which were agreed in that withdrawal treaty last year, as it now is. So he was building up to that, and that did seem to be perhaps getting some traction in other countries, in other capitals, perhaps in Brussels, although who knows what goes on in Brussels in August. But now that strategy appears to be undermined. The legs have been cut away from it because backbenchers in his own party, indeed people who only a few weeks ago were frontbenchers as well until Mr. Johnson got into power and sacked them from the government, and now from the parliamentary party as well, they had also looked at the problems of a no-deal Brexit, the threat of the economic damage that would be caused by it, and have said, I can't do this. I cannot do this to my own country. I'm not prepared to do this to my own country, and I'm going to do what it takes to try and stop a no-deal Brexit happening, even if that means defying the party whips and being booted out of my own party.
Yeah, we'll talk to Micheál in a moment, but I mean, just to pick up on that strategy of Boris Johnson, the way you've framed that there, I mean, I think, you know, there was, and you were in Beirut, Sean, at the G7, you know, there was a little bit of a, like the sun coming out, a sort of beam of sunlight, if you like, after that, because it was felt in Brussels that, you know, okay, whatever about Boris Johnson's position on the backstop and the threats to walk away on the 31st of October, he was seen in Beirut as being pretty much on message in terms of the EU's positioning with regard to Iran, perhaps climate change, and he was, I think there were some moments of relief that he could somehow diffuse the hulking presence of Donald Trump, and you know, make that chemistry perhaps less toxic or problematic than it might have been. And then, of course, he had that famous trip to Berlin and this seemingly warm encounter with Angela Merkel. And then another trip to Paris where he met Emmanuel Macron, and they seemed to be kind of grinning from ear to ear, the pair of them, in a fairly inscrutable fashion. And of course, the British press, the pro-Brexit press, if you like, seized on this as Boris Johnson already achieving a huge victory in Europe. Angela Merkel saying, OK, you've got 30 days to ditch the backstop. And then, of course, the German government were tripping over themselves to say, well, hang on a second, that's not exactly what we meant. She was just being polite. We could fix this in 2 years or we could fix it in 30 days. It was something of a turn of phrase. And that optimism or even triumphalism that was depicted in parts of the British press seemed to run out very quickly, because certainly it became clear here in Brussels and talking to some of the other capitals that this talk of momentum, of a breakthrough in the Brexit negotiations was simply unfounded, mainly because the British government had not put forward any proposals whatsoever, no concrete ideas. And that's really been the tenor of things this week in Brussels. While all the drama has been happening in Westminster, the European Commission has been at pains to point out every day that, yes, while David Frost, who's Boris Johnson's Sherpa or chief advisor or chief Brexit negotiator, he's been over, but he hasn't tabled any text which would spell out precisely how and in what way you would replace the backstop and still achieve the same outcome on the island of Ireland, which of course is no hard border, seamless trade, protecting the Good Friday Agreement and so on. And that then has rebounded back, I think, to Westminster. I think that perhaps emboldened some of the Tory rebels, because they simply didn't believe Boris Johnson when he was saying, that we're making progress, there's momentum, things, the tide is turning on the backstop. None of that seemed to be reflected in briefings and so on in Brussels. And there was quite a bit of eyebrow raising at Steve Barclay, the Brexit Secretary's tour around Europe, and he gave interviews to quite a number of European newspapers saying that, a deal was on the cards and different capitals were now turning on the backstop. So all of that seemed to backfire for Boris Johnson.
Yeah, it has backfired for him, and we could see it in the line of questioning over the past week in the Parliament, where Jeremy Corbyn in particular kept on saying, show us the plan, publish the plan, we want to see this great plan, what are your ideas, how are you going to deal with this backstop? And of course, there were no answers forthcoming. There are bits of things going on in the background, as I'm sure you know, Tony, all this talk about having a single veterinary and phytosanitary regime for Ireland, or some ideas that were put forward by the Ulster Unionist Party. There are people thinking of ideas, and some of them tick certain boxes that might make up some kind of an alternative to the backstop, but they are well short of what is required to actually replace the backstop, certainly at this stage. Maybe over the course of another 2 years of intensive negotiations, you might get to that point, but by the 31st of October, realistically, it's not going to be possible to replace the backstop, in my view, with anything that is at the level of detail that we've seen so far in this process. As for that 30-day deadline from Berlin story that gained great legs in the British media for a few days, as you say, I don't think they realise that the Germans, too, do irony. Even Angela Merkel, she was talking about, we thought we were going to have the 2 years in the standstill period after Brexit has happened to start working out these kind of details. But, maybe you think you can do it in 30 days. Go ahead. Let's see what you got. But as was pointed out in the House this week, a third of that period has elapsed already.
Exactly, yes, and that's the thing.
A line of information has emerged from the British side. There ain't nothing there to negotiate about, and that is the problem. And the fact that that has been exposed so ruthlessly by the opposition and by the Tory rebels, including former ministers, people like Phil Hammond, who are in those negotiations, who, as you and I have seen him going in and out of those EU meetings over the past couple of years, he's saying there's nothing there. So the credibility of that, this whole Boris Johnson position that we are negotiating something with Brussels and the opposition are undermining us, in the political circle, certainly it's been damaged. How badly damaged in the view of the electorate? Well, we're going to have to wait and see about that one.
Yeah, Micheál, let's hear from you now about the way this is all being viewed in Dublin. Obviously, this is a cataclysmic crisis, constitutional political crisis in the UK, and no matter what way you look at it, that thread of hedges and water and fields, otherwise known as the Irish border, is at the centre of it. That's really the existential question at the very heart of this crisis. So how are things being seen in the Irish political sphere, not just the machinations of Westminster, but also, of course, the government's no-deal preparations and the whole vexed question of will there be checks, what will they be like, and so on?
Yeah, and I suppose we had some greater degree of clarity this week when the cabinet came back and met for the first time since July, and the message that clearly emerged afterwards is that the view of the government here is that the chances now of a hard Brexit have increased. They were ranked as significant in July, and now concern has grown even further than that. And the bid to try and get more companies to be ready for Brexit and to increase the awareness about the necessary revenue registrations that's needed. Thousands of companies that do export to the UK still don't have them. That work will continue and you will see more campaigns, more advertisements placed throughout the country. And indeed, in the next few weeks when that huge event takes place, the National Ploughing Championships, where you have all strands of society, but particularly companies and those linked to agriculture, you'll see a big drive by government there to get that message out. But all the while, the big question from businesses and companies is what form would checks take? And you're only 50 days or more, just over 50 days potentially away from a hard Brexit. But still the detail around those checks to preserve the integrity of the single market, that has not been forthcoming. And the clamour grows louder within Irish politics now for those details. We do know that the Cabinet on Tuesday night had a fairly lengthy conversation about these topics and generally the preparations for a no-deal Brexit. But the document that was circulated to them at that meeting, such as the sensitivity of it, was taken back afterwards. But some of it is clear. There are fears that within the tourism and hospitality sector, you could see early job losses, perhaps to the tune of 10,000, and that there would be particular early worries too for the fishing sector. But the question and the pressure rising on government now about what checks could take place. And while there is, and there always has been really, a strong degree of political unity throughout the Dáil around the government's approach to this, it will grow even more intense now, the demand for more details on the government's no-deal planning.
Yeah, I mean, just to take one of the examples you mentioned there, I mean, people instinctively reach for the beef industry, the cheddar sector as being really exposed to the UK market. I suppose the first point to make is that I assume that checks at Dublin Port, would be pretty they'd be upfront about that. It's really the checks along the border that is the extremely sensitive thing.
That's it. I mean, and what has been said so far has been really limited. The guarantee that the checks won't take place at the border, that has been made repeatedly. The Taoiseach at one point in July as well also mentioned an increase of mobile or random checks, that would take place. That will be one of the mechanisms. But there is a lot more detail required. In relation to Dublin Port too, I think what you possibly will see in the next few weeks, moves afoot to plan for this, is a big rehearsal, if you like, or a big test just to see how ready the port would be if they were to face into a new reality on November 1st. I think that those kind of exercises too likely to play out in the weeks ahead.
And Micheál, we've seen, tantamount to a government of national unity in this Brexit era, with Fianna Fáil, pretty much on board with this confidence and supply agreement, wanting to not rock the boat too much in terms of a general election. How would you take the temperature of the opposition at the moment and Fianna Fáil in terms of the way that they are having to position themselves on this? Because obviously there is the national interest at stake, but yet, good old-fashioned Irish politics can't be ignored either.
Yeah, that's true. I think, though, there is a certain pride being taken within the political system in Ireland, and has been for a while, that as the unity has grown in the UK, there has been a fair degree of stability here. Talk of elections come and go every few months, but they do seem to have subsided for the most part. And of course, the focus then in the weeks ahead as well now, and you will see Fianna Fáil and the government in negotiations around the budget on October 8th. And of course, that too presents a key choice for the government, in the sense that what version of the budget will be presented on that day and what version will arise from those discussions with Fianna Fáil. Will it be something that might allow for modest tax cuts and spending increases, or will it keep everything the same? And will it be the Brexit budget, really, the one that prepares for the worst possible outcome and keeps some money back in reserve? And the expectation right now is that that's what it will be. Something will be kept back and all other spending and tax will be kept at a constant level. And of course, that is an unusual situation to be in, because there is a fair degree of predictions that would say, well, this possibly will be the last budget under this minority government's time in office. And Fianna Fáil, of course, pledging for one more budget, that this would be the last one. So you are going into, despite the great crisis that possibly looms there. It is still a pre-election budget, effectively, but it will be one that won't do those things that you expect from them, that is cutting tax and increasing spending, it seems at this point.
It's a question that I'm always asked, Micheál, if ever I'm interviewed on British radio or so on. They'll say, well, look, you know, the backstop is designed to prevent a hard border, but if Ireland doesn't compromise or agree to a time limit or something like that, then you're going to get a hard border anyway because of a no-deal situation. And, you know, is there no pressure on Leo Varadkar at home to rethink his policy on the backstop? But it seems that the opposition and, you know, the system in Ireland, notwithstanding, you know, some well-known Sunday newspaper commentators who are really going against the grain on the backstop, people like Dan O'Brien, Owen Harris and so on. I mean, it seems that there is still universal support for the backstop.
Yeah, that is the case. And of course, there was a symbolic vote on the withdrawal agreement last year in Dáil Éireann, and it got nearly universal approval there. And even as tension grew at certain points along the way, criticism over the government in relation to its planning around Brexit, there has at all points been unity on that big question of the backstop. And you could see that last year too when Michel Barnier addressed the Dáil, the Micheál Martin, the leader of the opposition, making it clear that on those questions, on those big questions, there were clear unity at all times. And that was the message emphasised again going into the summer break. So while the discussion has played out in the media, in political circles, it's not something that's there. And I think there is a resistance to any idea of a negotiation getting underway at any level that would provide for fixes, if you want to call it that, that would be a long way short of the strength that the backstop offers. And of course, if there is that meeting between Boris Johnson and the Taoiseach next week, if it does take place, again, the message coming from some within government and indeed from some outside it, that nothing can be perceived even that this is the beginning of a negotiation to allow for anything that would fall short of a real alternative to the backstop, which hasn't been put forward.
Yeah, I suppose because Boris Johnson was so aggressive in demanding the backstop be stripped out altogether, a demand that, you know, even he must have seen would be impossible for the Irish government. I think that probably took the pressure off the calculation in Dublin as to how to respond to his arrival on the scene. I would just make the point that I do hear a lot of people in the political system in Ireland saying, you know, we need detail on where these checks are going to be, what these checks are going to be like. The view in Brussels and in European capitals has been because the EU needs to protect the single market. There is also a certain amount of querying going on, and this dates back to last December's European Council. You know, what is Ireland going to do in a no-deal situation? How is Leo Varadkar going to make sure the single market is protected, that the checks and controls are carried out? Because if they aren't carried out properly, then you have an open back door into the single market, and nobody wants that. But, you know, talking to officials here in Brussels who would normally be intimately involved in the management of borders, in the Union Customs Code, as it's called, the single market acquis, the single market rulebook, I think there was a sense of frustration just running into the summer that, you know, there were no technical details or technical meetings going on as to how it would be managed at the Irish border in the event of no deal. What seemed to be happening was reduced almost exclusively to the political and diplomatic sphere. So now I think what that means is that, you know, the government and the European Commission were talking in very tight constrained circumstances about details here and there, but each detail had to be kind of assessed for its political impact. So these were almost like political discussions rather than anything else. But I would also say that, you know, there is a recognition among the different member states and within their permanent representatives here in Brussels, the people you talk to, that they fully understand that if Ireland was to suddenly spell out how all these checks away from the border and these facilitations would happen, then that would simply gift wrap a big present to Brexiteers who would say, you know, there you go, you don't need a backstop, you can have these checks away from the border, you can make sure there's you know, as frictionless trade as possible, so you know, the backstop is a nonsense, etc., etc. So I think there is an understanding in Brussels that that is the dilemma that the British government face. Sean, just getting back to you now with the obviously very fast-moving developments in London. I mean, what? Let's talk about a general election first of all. What? How could that? You know, when might that happen? What might the result be, given all of the parameters? And what might that mean for what happens at the end of October?
Oh, yeah, all the easy questions, Tony. this is week one in the job for me over here. But look, it's a great time to be here. In 20 seconds, if you can. Look, when's the election going to be? Don't know yet. We're hopefully going to find that one out next week. But it's all boiling down to this question of, is it going to be before or after that critical European Council meeting on October 17th, or the alternative date they're looking at, is it before or after October 31st? Because the opposition parties want to make sure that there isn't a no-deal Brexit on the 31st of October, and they want to make sure that there are no circumstances in which Boris Johnson or anybody else, in case Boris Johnson resigns on a matter of principle, refusing to go to the European Council to ask for an extension, somebody else might slip in and try and jimmy around with parliamentary procedure and run down the clock here. They want to make sure that there is no room for that, that Britain goes and looks for an extension to the Article 50 process in order to try and negotiate some sort of a deal. We also had an amendment slipped in by Stephen Kinnock, in somewhat controversial circumstances that haven't been fully worked out yet, but that amendment would call for the British government to resubmit the departure bill, the Brexit bill, the withdrawal agreement bill to the House of Commons, the one that Theresa May was unable to get through, and that they would use that 3-month period to, at the very least, have another run at giving approval to the withdrawal agreement as it is currently written, so that they wouldn't be just running down the clock and be back in this same position again come January next year of wondering what they're going to do. They will at least have something built into their timetable, if indeed we're still operating a parliament at that stage, because if the election is pushed later into November, maybe into December even, who knows, a lovely Christmas present for the British public.
I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, Boris Johnson's real ambition here seems to be to go to the European Council in the middle of October and get this deal. I mean, I think it's really worth pointing out that when the EU is negotiating a high level, you know, big ticket crisis issue with that is to do with its internal operation, like the Eurozone or something like that, then you do have these, 11th hour scrappy, bad-tempered deals that are done in the early hours of the morning, but they don't happen when the EU is negotiating with on an external issue, and that's what Brexit is. So the idea that there is something hatched on the backstop at 3 o'clock in the morning in Brussels during that summit, to me, is extremely fanciful. Also because, you know, the whole negotiation of Brexit was handed over to the European Commission and handed over to Michel Barnier as the EU, the European Council, EU leaders' chief negotiator, because the Commission has the expertise. They know how the single market works. They operate it. They're the ones to do the nitty-gritty of the negotiations. So it's just impossible to imagine, you know, 27 prime ministers sitting around a table in Brussels in the early hours trying to draft some kind of replacement to the backstop, which, as we know, is an extremely technical legal protocol in the middle of a 600-page treaty. So, you know, that's one thing to bear in mind. And also, if the European Commission is going to be conducting the future trade relationship with the United Kingdom, then they will not want to be sidelined at a European Council with prime ministers taking over. So I think that's something that is probably not properly or fully understood in the UK. Another point I would just add that we haven't really discussed in terms of what the UK want or what Boris Johnson's prepared to bring forward, but there is a real concern now in Brussels and in Dublin that he is completely downgrading the joint report of December 2017, which of course gave rise to the backstop. And that joint report spelled out what the backstop was there to do, and that was not, it was not just about avoiding infrastructure in the border, it was providing frictionless and seamless trade. And also, as we know, it's about protecting the all-island economy and North-South cooperation. Now, it seems fairly clear from Boris Johnson's letter to Donald Tusk a few weeks back and from the way that the European Commission has been processing what's been happening since, it seems fairly clear that Boris Johnson is resiling now from the joint report. He wants to strip out those promises. David Frost, his Sherpa, in one of his meetings here in Brussels, is reported to have said that the new administration in London regards the joint report as a conceptual mistake. So they're trying to renege from those promises, and that's certainly not going down very well in Brussels or indeed in Dublin, because it's a matter of trust.
Indeed. I'd also agree with what you said about the way negotiations are done in Brussels. I can't see any circumstance in which the prime ministers will want to actively get engaged in renegotiating the withdrawal agreement for all of the reasons you've said, and also for the fact that the council meetings, the way they're run these days, particularly under Donald Tusk, they are fairly short, sharp, crunchy affairs. They like to have a lot of the business pre-done so that they can avoid getting involved in big late night wrangles. And the meetings do tend to finish up at a reasonable hour these days. And I just don't see any circumstances in which 27 prime ministers are willingly going to submit themselves to that sort of thing. That's what they have Michel Barnier and his Task Force 54. As for the resiling from the joint report, that is a very serious matter in terms of the Irish government. But because of all the political drama that's been going on here in Westminster, I don't think it's really understood widely at all in political London, and not at all outside of political London.
Yeah, Michal, what's your view of what we've been seeing now from London in terms of you know, trying to strip down the joint report to something just involving avoiding, you know, clunky infrastructure at the border, but not much else?
Yeah, I think there definitely was a suspicion that that was happening. And again, it plays into the fear that there could be some emphasis made that perhaps some negotiation is happening with Dublin. And that's something that will be resisted if the meeting does take place with Boris Johnson and the Taoiseach. Again, it will be pointed out that everything will have to take place at the European level. And it shows difficulty that visit could pose for the Irish government, because initially when Boris Johnson did take over as British Prime Minister, there was an expectation that a meeting would take place quickly, but indeed it took some time for even a phone conversation to happen. But now the tables have turned somewhat, and Dublin happy to keep the focus on the negotiations taking place at the European level, very much so. And a suspicion, I think, at all points through the summer and through those weeks where Boris Johnson was saying many things, that everything was being set and the stage was being set for Westminster to ultimately make its way perhaps to a British general election, and that is what it was all about. That's what many of those statements were about, and perhaps not a great deal of seriousness or care taken about the statements in relation to Ireland, and certainly a fear about that watering down of what had been agreed in December 2017.
Great. OK, Michal, thanks for that. That's a good kind of preview of that meeting next week, which should be fascinating. And of course, yeah, I think you're right. The government in Dublin would be very wary about getting into any kind of anything that even resembles detailed negotiations. And also just I think probably just worth picking up on that idea of an all-island regime for food safety and animal health that Boris Johnson mentioned in the House of Commons a few days ago. I think that is seen in Dublin as trying to break the backstop down into different sectoral solutions which will not go down very well, simply for the reason that it doesn't deal with those other issues like, you know, goods, industrial goods, what happens to those at the border, and also again that the mapping exercise, all of the north-south cooperation, which is underpinned by mutual membership of the European Union, and I think as well, you know, an all-island animal health and food safety regime will pose problems for the EU's own trade deals with countries like Korea and so on, who have signed those trade agreements on the basis of the status quo of what happens with, you know, animals and foods production and the circulation of food and so on in the European Union. Sean, let's get a quick final word from you on what's going to happen next again, the easiest of questions.
All right, the easy questions. Look, Monday, they're going to have another go at trying to get that two-thirds majority to hold a general election. And the thing to really watch out for is what kind of arrangement can the opposition wring out of them to get the dates. The dates of the election are going to be the all-important thing. And if they're not happy about the kind of dates that are proposed and the security around those kind of dates to make sure that Boris Johnson can't renege and on what the House of Commons wants him to do, which is to get that extension and stop a no-deal Brexit happening on the 31st of October, then he mightn't get that two-thirds majority. So then he'd be pretty rightly snookered within a week of having this Parliament come back into office, because he's lost his parliamentary majority, but he can't even call an election as things stand. So we have to watch out for that. The other thing I'll be watching out for, though, is the amount of people dressed up in chicken suits chasing after the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, because Boris Johnson called him a chlorinated chicken during the debate. The
that's
other
not
night.
All they called him as well, actually.
Indeed, big girl's blouse as well. Now, we had a man standing outside Corbyn's house the next morning holding a big red girl's blouse. But we also spotted the first chicken of spring outside the Parliament on Thursday afternoon. A man in a chicken suit making loud chicken noises. The Sun newspaper had Mr. Corbyn's head superimposed onto a photograph of a hen. So here's the theme for the next few days, probably next week. Jeremy Corbyn, you're scared of an election, and people in chicken suits, maybe that's how you make your money. Import a load of chicken suits quickly and sell them to opponents of Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, and let's do it before they slap any tariffs on chicken suits, which would probably be high tariffs.
Great stuff. Thanks very much. They're all made in China anyway, Tony.
I never knew. There you go. Thanks very much, Sean Whelan, who is RTE's new London correspondent, who's got his work cut out for him in Westminster. And thanks to Micheál Lahan, RTE's political correspondent, giving us a very useful and detailed perspective from Dublin. And I'm Tony Connolly. I'm RTE's Europe editor in Brussels. We'll be back next week with a lot more of fun and frolics on Brexit Republic. Once again, thanks for listening.